Blog Talk Radio.
Remember later to thank Paul for that new intro music. All right. Welcome, everyone. We're back once again here on Blog Talk Radio, Tuesday night Bible study. We're going through the book of Acts. I'm your host, Andy Young, and I want to thank everyone who may be tuning in live with us tonight on the internet or listening, or you're going to be listening to us at some other time to the archived edition. Immediately, that will be available immediately following the program. Let me go ahead and give you the information that you need, the phone number. If you'd like to be a part of our program live here tonight, is area code 347-855-8317. Again, that's area code 347-855-8317. If you have a Skype account, you will notice on the program screen, you will see a little button there for Skype. You can go ahead and click on that Skype button. If you have a Skype account, that is, it is free for you to connect and join the program using your Skype account. If you'd like to send us an email regarding anything here on the program, you can email us at mail@ttanc.com. That's mail@ttanc.com, T-T-A-N-C. Or if you'd like to make comments on the program screen itself, you can scroll down to the bottom of the program screen, and you'll see a spot there at the bottom where you can enter comments. All right, let's get started here tonight. Where have we left off? Let's take a minute here and just go back and review what we've been studying. We are in the middle of the third missionary journey, and we have been spending some time in Ephesus with Paul. Last week, what did we study last week? Let's see. Paul, yes, something different happened on this missionary journey that hasn't happened before. With Paul, we saw Paul in this particular point in the journey. Now Paul is performing miracles. He's doing all kinds of signs and wonders here in Ephesus. People are coming to him for healing, and he's casting out evil spirits. And in fact, we also saw that Paul didn't even actually have to go to the people he was healing. What he would actually do, he could send them actually a garment and have a garment that was taken to the person who needed healing. And either his infirmity would be healed or the evil spirit would be cast out. This would have been an article of clothing that Paul would have physically worn on his body. So this could have been either his own personal item or perhaps the person who needed healing had an article of clothing sent to Paul, and Paul touched it or handled it or wore it in some way, and then sent that article of clothing back to the person who needed the healing. And then their infirmity was healed or that evil spirit was cast out of them. But why all of a sudden do we see Paul now performing miracles here in Ephesus? He's never done this before up to this point. And when we looked at this, we saw the comparison that happened with Moses when he went before Pharaoh, right before the 10 plagues. And Moses was to go before Pharaoh and perform signs and wonders in front of Pharaoh. And we saw how Pharaoh's magicians were able to duplicate the same kinds of things that Moses was able to do, but yet they were counterfeits of the original. And this is what we saw happening here in Ephesus with Paul and these workings of these signs and wonders. It was to authenticate his ministry. It was to authenticate his works from reprobate works or counterfeit works. And then we saw these vagabond Jews who were really nothing more than false teachers. But these vagabond Jews, as they were called, who also had the ability to go around and perform similar signs and wonders, but all of a sudden, they decide that they're going to start invoking Jesus' name. And we saw what happened. In fact, they didn't even invoke Jesus' name directly. They kind of went through Paul. It's like, we command you in the name of Jesus, whom Paul teaches, to come out. And of course, what happened with the demon said, we know Paul and we know Jesus, but who are you guys? And of course, the demon-possessed man then set upon these seven fellows, these seven sons of the chief priest is who they were, and attacked them and stripped them naked, and they were humiliated. And it was made clear that what these men were doing was counterfeit, a counterfeit version of what Paul was actually performing. So these signs and wonders that Paul was doing helped serve to authenticate his ministry from that which was reprobate or that which was counterfeit. So that was our lesson last week, and that's where we left off. And we're back again, still in Acts chapter 19. We're going to finish Acts chapter 19 tonight. So go ahead and take your Bibles and turn to Acts chapter 15. And we're going to begin with verse 21, and then we're actually going to go all the way to the end of the chapter and briefly looking at the first verse of chapter 20. So our text is going to be Acts 19, verse 21, through chapter 20, verse 1. Verse 1 of chapter 20 actually is kind of the tail end of this particular section of the narrative, this particular scene that we're looking at, going to look at here in Ephesus tonight. So we're still with Paul in Ephesus. As we get into the text tonight, Luke begins with this short parenthetical thought that almost seems to be out of place. It almost seems to be out of place in the narrative, in the order of things that are happening. Let's look at this briefly. Beginning in verse 21, go ahead and follow along with me. As usual, I'm reading from the King James. That's just my preference. If you have a different version, translation that you're reading from, do your best to follow along. It shouldn't be all that difficult. Beginning in verse 21, follow along with me. After these things were ended, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, that being Jerusalem, I must also see Rome. So he sent into Macedonia two of them that ministered unto him, Timotheus and Erastus. But he himself stayed in Asia for a season. All right, so let's stop right there for a second. Now, like I said, this particular thought seems to be out of place. Luke is jumping ahead a little bit, it seems like, to tell us that ultimately Paul is going to end up here at the end of this third missionary journey. Not in Ephesus yet. We still have one major event that takes place before Paul continues on, but Luke kind of foreshadows a little bit. He kind of gives us this little phrase. It says, eventually he's going to get here. He uses this phrase, after these things were ended. This seems to be a reference not only to those events that we just studied last week and the week before, but also having to do with this next event in chapter 19. Paul has some things to take care of in Ephesus. But eventually he wants to visit those assemblies in these provinces of Macedonia and Achaia. Macedonia, that would include Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica, and in Achaia, you would have Corinth and Cenchrea. And you remember, those were cities that he visited on the second missionary journey. And so he wants to go back there, but since he still has some things to finalize here in Ephesus before he goes on, he sends Timothy and this other individual named Erastus. He sends them on ahead, kind of preparing things for him before he gets there, to let them know that he's coming. Now, Timothy, we already know, okay? We met Timothy in the second missionary journey. Paul and Silas picked up Timothy in Derbe and Lystra at the very beginning of the second missionary journey, and he's been with them ever since. But this individual, Erastus, we've never seen mentioned before, but his name comes up two other times in the New Testament. If you were to, one time is at the end of Romans. The epistle of Romans. He wrote that from Corinth. In his closing greetings in Romans, chapter 16, in verse 23, Paul writes, Erastus, the chamberlain of the city, saluteth, okay? So basically he's saying, I'm here in Corinth, I'm writing to you in Rome. By the way, Erastus says hi, okay? So apparently, after Paul sends Erastus on ahead here in Acts chapter 19, Erastus ends up staying in Corinth. And he actually becomes involved there in some political function. See that? Specifically, the chamberlain of the city of Corinth. And the chamberlain would be like the city treasurer. Okay, he's in charge of the finances of the city. Okay, so that's a pretty important function there in Corinth. Excuse me. Now, the second instance where we see Erastus is found in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 20. And, of course, the epistle of 2 Timothy was written from Rome just before Paul was going to be executed. So in this reference, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 20, Paul simply acknowledges that Erastus is staying at Corinth, just verifying something that we already know. Okay, so not too much to be said about Erastus, but we do see his name come up a couple other times in the New Testament. Also notice that Luke says that they ministered to Paul. They ministered to Paul. Now, what does that mean? Well, the word here for ministered should be a familiar word to us. Ministered. Okay? It's the word diakoneo. Diakoneo. That should sound familiar to us. Of course, it's the word for deacon. We get the word deacon from this word diakoneo, a minister, one who serves. Okay, Timothy and Erastus served Paul. They ministered to him. They did whatever Paul needed to have done. Okay, Paul could count on them if there was something Paul needed done, he could count on them. Now compare this, you compare this to what happened back in Acts chapter 6. Think back with me to Acts chapter 6, what happened there? You have the apostles instructing the assemblies there in Jerusalem to select some men to serve in a specific capacity. You remember what that was, right? They needed someone to oversee the distribution to the widows. And so they selected 7 men for this job. The apostles didn't select them. The assemblies, okay? the assemblies selected their own men to handle this, and they selected 7 men for this job. Okay, and the word that is used there for serving or for ministering is again this word diakoneo, this area of service. Of course, this is from there that we get this idea of the office of a deacon. Okay. From this particular passage in Acts chapter 6. And here, in the same way, Paul needed someone to go on ahead on the journey while he stayed back in Ephesus for a while to finalize some things. And so Timothy and Erastus served Paul in this capacity. And while I'm on the subject, tradition has taught us tradition has taught us that Timothy was a pastor, right? You've probably heard that Timothy was a pastor, and they call the epistles of 1st and 2nd Timothy pastoral epistles. You've probably heard of that, okay? But I think looking at the role Timothy played, if you study it carefully, I think it would be more accurate to say that Timothy functioned more like a deacon than a pastor or an elder or an overseer. Okay? All right, so that's all I'm going to cover on those two little verses here in Acts chapter 19. Let's move on into the meat of tonight's lesson. Let's pick up reading in verse 23. At the same time, okay, that means at the same time that Paul is sending Erastus and Timothy on ahead to Macedonia, at the same time there arose no small stir about that way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation, and said, "Sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed. Asia and the world worship it." Excuse me. I apologize for that cough. Let's take some time here to try and understand the significance of all this, okay? Now, Diana was a Roman goddess. Okay, in the Roman mythology, you have the goddess Diana. She was the moon goddess, as well as the goddess of the hunt, and also the goddess of fertility. Now, if you look on the program screen for this program tonight, you'll see in the slideshow, you'll see some images going across your screen there through the slideshow. I've included a few pictures here of the goddess Diana. And you'll see one there that looks like a young lady standing next to what looks like some kind of deer or elk of some kind of animal. This would have been the Roman Roman manifestation, for lack of a better word, the Roman rendering of Diana, since she was a Roman goddess. Okay. And of course, having her pose there with an animal attests to her being the goddess of the hunt. In Greek mythology, you have the equivalent to Diana, which would be Artemis. So Artemis and Diana are the same thing, would be the equivalent in both Roman and Greek mythology. And of course, with the expansion of the Roman Empire taking over all these regions of Greece, the Greek culture would have adopted the Roman mythology, and so Artemis would have now been recognized as Diana. It seems that Diana held special significance there in Ephesus. In Ephesus, they had their own temple dedicated specifically to the worship of Diana. And if you look also in that slideshow, I've included a picture of a model replica of the Temple of Diana. I want to show you how important the Ephesians viewed Diana in their culture. The Temple of Diana was the size, covered the area of a football field. Okay, so you're talking approximately, including the end zone, so you're talking approximately 330 feet long by about 60 or 70 feet wide, probably more than, maybe like more like 100 feet wide. This was a large structure. It was significantly larger than even the Parthenon in Athens. And of course, the Parthenon in Athens was recognized as a great structure. The Temple of Diana was even larger and even more grand than the Parthenon. So it was quite a structure. And it just goes to, it attests to the importance that the Ephesians placed on Diana. She even appeared on their coinage. I've also included a picture there of an old Ephesian coin that has the image of their goddess Diana on it. In addition to the large temple structure, people would create shrines for Diana in their own homes. And you're probably familiar with people having shrines in their homes, particularly Buddhists will do something similar. They'll create a space in one side of a major room in their house. In Mexico, the devout Roman Catholics in Mexico will do something very similar, and they'll set up a shrine for Mary. Okay? And what it is, it's a little dedicated space in their house where they have a little area set up and probably a small statue of the image of Diana set up in that shrine. Okay? Now, here in our text, we're introduced to a man named Demetrius, who crafted what it says silver shrines, but this is more likely a reference specifically to the small statues of Diana that the people would purchase for these little shrines they set up in their homes. Okay, you got that? You with me on that? Okay. Now, notice the expression that Luke uses in verse 21 here. Verse 21 says, there was no small stir about that way. Notice that. It didn't say Christianity. Okay? Remember, in this particular time period we're talking about, the term Christian was a pejorative term. And you remember, the believers were first called Christians in Antioch, but it was used as a pejorative term. It wasn't a compliment. It was an insult to be called a Christian. Okay, it was used mockingly for these people. But also, the term Christian was generally localized to that area around Antioch and probably down in that region where Israel is. So it was very limited usage at the time. At this particular period, in the rest of the world, in the rest of Asia Minor, where Paul was ministering, believers were referred to as followers of the way. Got that? Followers of the way. So that's why Luke uses that reference here. There was no small stir about that way. What is that way? It is this teaching regarding Jesus. All the things that Paul was teaching about. And so believers were called followers of the way. So we have this opening statement preparing us for what is to come. There is no small stir. Why? Luke goes on to tell us, and it revolves around this man, Demetrius. Am I saying that right? Is it Demetrius? No. Yes, Demetrius. Okay. I keep wanting to say Demaricus, but that's not right. It's Demetrius. Okay. Now, Paul, as a threat to his livelihood. Why? Okay. He makes his living selling idols to idol worshippers. Okay, pretty obvious. It should be obvious to us, as it was to Demetrius, that if Paul is successful in turning people away from idols, then fewer people will purchase silver idols of Diana, right? And there goes Demetrius' way of life. So this begs the question, then, what was Demetrius' motivation here? Was he genuinely concerned about the integrity of their goddess? Or was he simply acting out of self-preservation? From what we see here in the text, it appears to be self-preservation. But notice that he still makes this pretense about being concerned for Diana in order to help make his case, in order to help garner support for what he's about to do here. Look at the end of verse 24. Luke makes a point of telling us that the crafting of these statues of Diana was very lucrative. These guys got very rich off of this. And Demetrius calls together all of the other silversmiths who also make Diana statues. And notice the first point that he brings up. He says, "We get our wealth from this craft." Do you see what the most important thing is to these guys? Not the honor of Diana, it's their wealth. Now, that is not to say that they didn't honor Diana. But I do think it's worth noting that what is of primary importance to these guys is the wealth they make off of religion. Let me say that again. What is of primary importance to them is the wealth they make off of religion. Now, this is not something that is unique to pagan religion. The very same thing happens in Christianity. You have those who claim to be men of God, making nothing more than a pretense of their faith, and are investing in nothing more than using religion to gain personal wealth. And we see that happening today. And this happened back in the first century. If you need proof of it, turn with me to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Go ahead and keep your finger there in Acts chapter 19 and turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 6. And in 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul is writing to Timothy about some teachers that have come into the church. Excuse me, into the assembly. Okay, Freudian slip there. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 2. Paul writes to Timothy, "And they that have believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather do them service because they are faithful and beloved, partakers of the benefit. These things teach and exhort. If any man teach otherwise and consent not to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which is according to godliness." Okay, let me set this up here. Okay. Paul had just been talking about the role of servants in the assemblies, and he's saying apparently there were some men who had come into the assemblies that were saying, "Hey, you've got masters and you've got servants, but we're all brethren now. We're all on an equal footing." So they were actually teaching the servants, because you're all believers now, because you're all brothers and sisters in Christ, you servants don't have to obey your masters anymore. Okay? You shouldn't have to obey your master anymore. In fact, Masters shouldn't even have servants. Okay, so there were these men that were coming in and teaching this, and Paul is saying, no, that's not right. Servants, don't despise your believing masters. In fact, you need to make sure you try even harder to be good servants to them. Okay? So what Paul is saying here in 1 Timothy, if any man teach otherwise, look at verse 4. He is proud, knowing nothing, but doting about questions and strifes of words. Wherefore cometh envy, strife, railings, evil surmising, perverse disputings with corrupt minds, and destitute of the truth. Now look at this. Supposing that gain is godliness, from such withdraw thyself. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some coveted after, look at this, they have erred from the faith through with many sorrows. So here, Paul is addressing to Timothy specifically these teachers who have come into the assembly teaching things contrary to doctrine, and they're doing it for the specific purpose of trying to get rich off of religion. You see that in that passage? Let's look at another one. Go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. And let's look at verses 1 through 3. Verses 1 through 3. Peter writes, but there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privately shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of the truth shall be evil spoken of. And through covetousness, pay attention now here, here's the key verse, and through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. What is their motivation? To get rich at your expense, to make merchandise of you. See that? Okay. One other reference I want to look at. Turn to the book of Jude. The book of Jude. And let's look at verses 10 through 13. Book of Jude, starting with verse 10 through 13. Again, Jude is talking about false teachers. Verse 10. These speak evil of those things which they know not. But what they know naturally as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves. Woe unto them! For they have gone in the way of Cain, look at this, and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward. Remember Balaam in the book of Numbers? He was paid a great sum by Balak to curse Israel, right? Balaam's motivation for cursing Israel was the large sum of money he was going to receive for the job, okay? And perished in the gainsaying of Korah. These are spots in your, these are not some kind words here. These are spots in your feast of charity, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are with water. Excuse me, clouds they are without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. Wandering stars to whom it is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. As if you didn't, now go ahead and turn back to our text in Acts chapter 19. As if you didn't need any more evidence as if you didn't need any more evidence that Christianity is big business. Forget for a moment the huge salaries paid to pastors these days. Forget the multi-million dollar church budgets. Forget all the building programs. Forget all the endless appeals for more and more giving in the offering plate. If you don't believe that Christianity is big business, just walk into your local Lifeway Christian bookstore. I'd be very surprised if you didn't have a Lifeway Christian bookstore in your local, in your town, your city where you live. If you don't, you probably got some other Christian bookstore, but Lifeway is the biggest one right now. Okay. Walk into your local Christian bookstore. You want to talk about the who's who of Christianity making merchandise of people, as Peter said? Think of the millions of dollars that people invest in purchasing the countless volumes of Christian books published every year. Okay? They're not making silver shrines to Diana. They're pumping out books, and the people are buying them. And the more the people buy them, the more books they pump out. This is what we're up against. And don't think for one minute that if that source of livelihood was threatened, that the religious industrial machine wouldn't move heaven and earth to protect it. Now look at how the religious industrial machine of Ephesus responded. Demetrius gathers all the other silversmiths and motivates them. Our source of wealth is at stake. Okay? The primary motivation, wealth. This man Paul is going all over Asia Minor, teaching that there are no gods made with hands. Stop there. Okay, look at that. Do you see that? Do you see the irony of that right there? This is an explicit acknowledgement that these men know that they are actually making their own gods. Okay? You see that? They know what they're doing. They are making their own gods. They worship a god made with their own hands. But yet, somehow, Diana is still real to them. Okay? What kind of disconnection from reality is this? Okay? Do you see how messed up this is? And this is what happens when your interpretation of reality is messed up. Your logic doesn't make any sense. But then notice the subtlety here. Demetrius shifts the emphasis from wealth over to Diana's honor. Notice the pretense that is made about Diana. It is an attempt to give validation to their wealth. And here we have this reference to the temple. Okay? All right? I showed you that picture of the temple of Diana there in Ephesus. This huge, elaborate structure. The magnificence of the Temple of Diana and how it was such a monument for these people and the pride that was associated with it. If we let Paul get away with this, okay, these guys are saying, if we let Paul get away with this, it's going to diminish this glorious temple we have of Diana. All the world acknowledges this. We won't be the center of attention anymore because Diana won't be the center of attention. So we have this appeal, this pretense of an appeal made to Diana's honor. Now let's look at the next paragraph. Look at verse 28. When they heard these things, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians!" And the whole city was filled with confusion, and having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. And when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not. And certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, sent unto him, desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theater. Now, again, if you look down on the program page in the slideshow, I've also included a picture of the theater of Ephesus. Okay, you see that? The theater of Ephesus. This was a multi-purpose venue. It was used for artistic performances, drama, music, what have you. It was also used as a venue for public debate and also as a judicial forum. Okay, so now you've got these silversmiths all worked up into a frenzy, full of wrath towards Paul, and they begin to riot. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is the Diana of the Ephesians. And this riot spread into the whole city, and everyone, city of Ephesus, getting all caught in the emotion of this. What's going on? What's going on here? They're all calling out about Diana. What's going on? And as a result, they get a hold of Gaius and Aristarchus, these friends of Paul, these companions who are traveling with Paul, and the crowd carries them away into the theater to bring some accusations against them. Okay? This is to be a public hearing. Obviously, they know that these two men were with Paul. And perhaps they were actually looking for Paul himself, but they couldn't find him. So they do the next best thing. They grab Gaius and Aristarchus, most likely in an attempt to draw Paul out. And that's probably a reasonable conclusion, because you see that Paul does show up, doesn't he? And he tries to go into the theater. But the other believers there in Ephesus, they stop and say, "No, Paul, don't go in there. Okay, you don't want to go in there." And they try to stop him. They know exactly what's going on. Okay, this is a lynching. Okay, they've probably witnessed similar situations before in their city. And so they're probably aware of what this mob is trying to do. This is all designed to try and draw out Paul so that they can get their hands on him. So they stop him. And notice this. Paul gives some good legal advice. It says, certain of the chief of Asia, I like this phrase, which were his friends. You see how Luke kind of sticks that in there? Notice this. Paul has friends in high places. You remember Gallio? I don't know that we could necessarily refer to Gallio as one of Paul's friends, but think back a couple weeks ago when Paul was in Corinth. Gallio was the governor of that region. And remember how Gallio wouldn't let the Jews use the force of law to enforce their own religious beliefs? And here it doesn't say that these men, these chief of Asia, it doesn't say that these men were believers, but it does say that they were his, back with me to a few lessons ago. This would have been lesson 48, when we examined when Jesus spoke to Paul in Corinth, right before he was taken to Gallio. Jesus told Paul, "I have much people in this city." Do you remember that? This wasn't a reference to the number of people who would believe or be saved. This was a reference to the fact that there were people who would come to his defense. And here, once again, we see that alluded to here in Ephesus. You have influential people in high places throughout all of Asia Minor, giving Paul legal advice. And they're his friends, not necessarily brethren, right? Not necessarily believers, but they're his friends. Now let's look at this next paragraph, verse 32. "Some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused." Please underline that word assembly. Okay? Underline that word assembly. "And the more part knew not wherefore they were come together. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander beckoned with the hand and would have made his defense unto the people. But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice, about the space of 2 hours, cried out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians!" All right. Now, I had you underline that word assembly. And even the ESV translates this word assembly. I want you to see this. This is the Greek word ekklesia. Ekklesia. This word is going to appear two more times in our text for tonight. Please let your eyes fall down to verse 39. In verse 39, it says, "But if ye inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly." Please underline that word assembly there in verse 39. Go down even farther to verse 41. In verse 41, it says, "And when he had thus spoken, he dismissed the assembly." Again, please underline that word assembly in verse 41. Now, I want you to grasp something here. Can you tell me how this word ekklesia is usually translated? Anybody know? Okay. Church. Right. Okay. Everywhere in the New Testament, this word ekklesia is translated church. The only exception is these three instances here in Acts 19. And even the ESV translates this assembly. Okay. This is a purposeful deception on the part of the Reformed translators of our English Bible. Yes. Even the revered King James Version. This fact becomes even more apparent when you understand that the Greek word ekklesia is a secular term, not a religious one. Did you catch that? Let me say it again. The Greek word ekklesia is a secular term and not, I say again, not a religious one. Okay, let me say it again. Get it ingrained into your mind. Ekklesia is not a religious term. It is a secular term. Why do I say this? The fact is apparent here in our text in chapter 19. Ekklesia is actually a political word used to describe a group of people gathered together for a common purpose, such as a government function. For example, when debate was required over legislation, they would call together, they would assemble an ekklesia for the specific purpose of debating legislation, or perhaps for a judicial hearing of some kind. Okay? Remember, that was one of the purposes of the theater there in Ephesians. I already mentioned this. And that's exactly what we see happening here. We have an assembly of people gathered together in this theater to discuss these accusations that, what's his name? I can't think of his name now. I drew a blank. Give me a second. You're probably already ahead of me here. Demetrius. I just had a complete brain stutter. I completely forgot his name. All right. Let me get back on track here. Okay. So the purpose of this theater is one of the purposes of this theater in Ephesus for a judicial hearing. And they would gather together, they would call an ekklesia to hear these things out. But the thing about an ekklesia, it had to be carried out in an orderly manner. Otherwise, it would be deemed an illegal assembly, an unlawful assembly. And the participants in the ekklesia could actually be themselves arrested for rioting. Now, that point alone there is significant because verse 32 tells us, ecclesia, okay, this assembly that's gathered here in the theater is confused. They are all gathered together, all assembled there in the theater. If this was to be a lawful assembly, it had to be orderly, but these people didn't know why they were there. Isn't that something? They don't even know why they're there. And as we see, things are escalating to the point of getting out of hand. And of course, this plays right into the hands of the Jewish religious leaders. Okay, the Jewish religious leaders there in Ephesus, they would like nothing better than to have the city in an uproar over Paul and these teachings about Jesus. So what do? Well, they send out Alexander out in front of the crowd. And Alexander must be one of the believers, okay, one of Paul's disciples, okay. Alexander gets up and he stands before this ecclesia to state his case. But the crowd recognizes that, hey, this guy is a Jew. He's one of the troublemakers. And so this just serves to get them even more riled up. And so they shout him down by yelling, great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is the Diana of Ephesians. Over and over and over. And Alexander can't be heard because of all the shouting that's going on. And this goes on for 2 hours. 2 hours. Imagine that. All right. Now let's get through this last paragraph here. And then we'll get to some phone calls. Again, if you'd like to be part of the program tonight, you can go ahead and call the number to call in is area code 347-855-8317. And that's 347-855-8317. Or if you have a Skype account, it is free for you to connect using your Skype account. We're getting here to the last paragraph of our text, and then we'll get into some phone calls and some discussion. All right, verse 35, and when the town clerk had appeased the people, he said, ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of the Ephesians is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Jupiter? Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, ye ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly, for ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, please underline that word churches, I'll come back to that in a second, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen which are with him have a matter against any man, the law is open, and there are deputies. Let them implead one another. But if ye inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly. For we are in danger to be called in question for this day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse. And when he had thus spoken, he dismissed the assembly. And after the uproar was ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples and embraced them and departed for to go unto Macedonia. Hey, the voice of reason finally steps in here. You have this town clerk who somehow manages to get the people to quiet down long enough for him to be heard. I don't know if he came in with some law enforcement, some kind of security to make a show of force, but somehow he gets the people to quiet down long enough for him to be heard. Now, look, I want you to notice, will you look at how rational and reasonable this man is? Can you just hear this in his tone? Look at how he appeals to the people's sense of reason. He says, ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of Ephesians is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Jupiter? Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, ye ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly. Okay? What is he saying here? basically what he's saying. Now think about this. Okay, put your thinking caps on here. Engage your brains for a minute. What is he saying? If indeed this is a matter of logic here. Okay, he's appealing to their sense of logic. He's saying, if all these things about Diana are true, okay, or if what we know about Diana is really true, okay, if someone speaks against it, does that make it not true? Okay, so can you see that? Can she really be spoken against if she really is who we think she is? If Diana is real, what harm is there in somebody speaking against her if it's true? Okay, let me put this in more practical terms. Okay, and try and help. Okay, to help try and grasp what's going on here. Okay, if someone calls you a skunk, does that really make you a skunk? Okay, it's this is the same train of logic that this towns clerk is using. Just because somebody makes a claim about something they believe doesn't make it true. Do you see that? Okay. And this is a very profound statement by this town clerk. Okay. This is incredible insight. He is pointing out their irrational behavior. They are getting riled up because of something someone said, as if that actually made it true. Okay? Now, let's not take away from the facts that what Paul is teaching is based on clear evidence, as well as first-hand accounts from credible witnesses. Okay? We're not going to deny that. But as far as these men in Ephesus are concerned, it is still up to those hearing to choose to believe it or not. And, you know, if someone chooses not to believe what they're told, has that really done any harm to their perception of reality? Has it really changed anything? No, none whatsoever. If you're an atheist and you don't believe in God, how does my telling you that there is a God and presenting to you evidence of that really affect you? Okay? It doesn't. It shouldn't matter to you what I believe. You can still go right on believing what you believe. There's nothing wrong. I haven't harmed you in any way. Okay? And this is exactly the point the town clerk is making to this assembly. And so since this is the case, okay, since they're in their minds, Paul's teaching doesn't change anything, they just need to be quiet and be very careful with how they proceed, right? Stop protesting so much, okay? Well, this would be good advice for some of those reformed guys that comment on Paul's blog, on Paul's passing thoughts, okay? They protest so much, and it gets to the point where any rational observer would conclude, hey, if this is such a big deal to them, maybe Paul's got a point. You know, maybe he's saying something that's worth looking at, okay? Maybe what Paul's saying in this article about Reformed theology has some merit, needs to be considered, right? Why is it such a threat to them? This town clerk tells this ecclesia, we know that what Paul says about what Diana is not true. It's not a threat to what we believe, so stop making such a fuss, okay? In fact, he goes even further. And he declares to the ecclesia, these guys, Paul and the other disciples, they've never spoken anything against Diana. Okay? Look at verse 37. You're going to find this interesting. I had you underline that word churches. We see this phrase, robbers of churches. Now, this is interesting. I made this point to show you the usage of the word ecclesia being translated here in chapter 19, assembly, instead of church. And now, all of a sudden, we see the word church. But get this, okay? This usage of the word church in verse 37 is not the Greek word ekklesia. Okay, you with me here? Follow me. This word translated churches is not ekklesia. Actually, this entire phrase, robbers of churches, is only one word in the Greek. It's the word hierosulos. Hierosulos. Literally, it means temple despoilers. Okay? You've got the word hieron, okay? Hieron, which refers to a sacred place, like a temple. Okay? And the word sulao, sulao, which means to strip or to take for oneself, okay, like plunder, okay, like when you an invading army goes into a town and they plunder, they spoil, they take their spoils, the spoils of war back with them, okay. So this word hierosulos, these temple despoilers, this has the idea of taking the glory away from a sacred place, take it for yourself, right? So they're accusing, the accusation here, Paul, this town's clerk is saying, Paul and these other guys, they've never sought to take the glory away from Diana's temple and bring it to themselves. They've never done that, okay? But you notice the confusion that's created here using this term church in reference to a pagan worship site. You see how important it was that we took the time to investigate these words and understand what they mean in their proper grammatical context. So this town's clerk says they've never sought to take away the glory of the temple and claim it for themselves, and they've never said anything evil about Diana. And all that is true. All Paul has ever taught is that there is one God, Jehovah, and salvation through the Son, Jesus. Okay? And this town's clerk is saying they've never blasphemed Diana. Yes, they're talking about Jehovah and Jesus, but they've never badmouthed Diana. So now that, notice the continued appeal to reason here in verse 38. So if Demetrius, craftsmen which are with him, have a matter against any, the law is open, and there are deputies. Let them implead one another. But if ye inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly, for we are in danger to be called in question for this day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse. You guys need to handle this matter lawfully. Bring your case against them in a proper judicial forum, not a riotous uproar like this. Do you see that? Do you see how an ecclesia, an assembly, had to be done properly? This is a secular term. Body of people is going to gather like this. It must be done lawfully. Otherwise, we can be arrested for rioting. This was a big deal. It was a big deal. The rule of law is at stake here. And so, once the people hear this, okay, this town's clerk has appealed to their reason, and he's gotten them to calm down, and they realize how they were acting rashly. Look what happened. The people dispersed. The assembly was dismissed. And just like what happened in Gallio, what happened? You have government officials stepping in and saying, you are not going to disrespect our laws. We have laws about certain things, and you are not going to use the law to try and carry out your own agenda. Whether the Jews tried to do it with Gallio, they tried by taking advantage of something Demetrius had started here in Ephesus. And in both instances, what happened? You have the secular. You have unbelievers standing up for Paul and the disciples. And consider just how God has been taking care of Paul and how he used these circumstances. And my mind, again, I can't help but go back once again to what Jesus said to Paul in Corinth when he said, I have much people in this city. The significance of that is just stands out the more we see this. There are people here who will come to your defense. And so I hope this helps you see these events in a little different perspective. We want to take some callers now, and I know we have Paul and Susan waiting on the line here. And if anybody else wants to call in and join the discussion, if you have any comments you want to make or any questions, again, phone number is 347-855-8317, or you can connect using your Skype account. It's free to connect using Skype. I have Paul on the line with me now. Paul, you're with us on the program. How are you tonight?
Oh, sore. Been doing a lot of landscaping today. But other than that, just Dandy, thanks for the lesson tonight. You know, excuse me. You know, it's pretty clear that there's no reason whatsoever. Ecclesia throughout the New Testament would be translated church. You know, it is a secular word that can be attributed to any kind of, you know, gathering for a purpose. A purpose-built building for religious purposes is what we call a temple. And actually, I think it's more than fair to say, you know, temples traditionally have an infrastructure and authority and everything that goes, you know, with it. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, what we have in contemporary Christianity dotted along the roadsides, those are temples. Okay?
Yes.
And, yep. You know, as a former Reformed elder, I'm the one that dealt with the finances. Okay? And I was an elder of a fairly, you know, there were, I think, 300 members or something like that. And our budget was, about $450,000 a year budget. But infrastructure, the budget, look, as elders, we were totally consumed by that stuff. You know, that's something I saw for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm glad you pointed that out tonight. You know, and again, there's just no reason whatsoever that Ecclesia is translated church throughout the Bible. And basically, I think if you research it, you'll probably find that any building, including, you know, when you talk about Judeo-Christianity, which at one time we had the temple, you know, which was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
We had the tabernacle that was, you know, a portable temple. But in the etymology of the word, any purpose-built building for religious purposes has always been a temple.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know...
Well, what you've got there, I mean, full deception, in my opinion, because there's that subtle connotation of what the word does in your mind. When you say church, it's ever so very subtle, but once that gets ingrained into your subconscious, you automatically start thinking that you start thinking of the building or the place that you go to. We say it to our, we've said it to our kids. Hey, get ready, we're going to church.
Right.
You got to hurry up and get to bed. We got to get up to go to church tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just part of our lexicon, that the idea that church is the place that you go to. But clearly, the word ecclesia, in the proper understanding of it, the emphasis is not on a place. It is on the body of people.
Right.
It is clearly descriptive of the people. And so, therefore, it is by no means any coincidence that in God's holy inspired word, that he refers to the body of Christ is referred to as an ecclesia, because that the emphasis there is on the people.
Right. Well, I've still, not done a lot, horrible amount of, or a lot of studying that. I mean, I guess ecclesia, is it specifically, like in the passages you looked at tonight, is it specifically ecclesia?
Yes, it's the exact same word.
Right.
It's the exact same word. You can actually, if you were to do a concordance search on that through your Greek dictionary, you can easily find every instance of that word, and in every place in the New Testament, it's translated church, except these three instances in Acts 19.
Yeah.
Now tell me that's not purposeful.
And then, where you have church, it's actually temple.
Yes.
Yeah, that is very interesting. Now, if it's the exact same word, you have the word ek in there. Right?
Right.
Which means out of or out?
Yes.
So
and kaleo, which means call.
So basically the word itself infers a purpose, a meeting called for a specific purpose.
Correct. Correct.
So,
literally it means out called.
Right. Okay. So, all right. So, good lesson tonight. That's the one thing that I focused on. And then, of course, the whole religion and money that you pointed out and about the Christian bookstores and this, that, and the other. There's serious money to be made in religion, and again though, one of the constant focus of the elders, I was never comfortable with it. It kind of was what it was. But as a pastor and an elder, you know, you were never comfortable with it, but you just accepted it for what it was. But every church I was a leader of, and I'll just go ahead and say it, it was a business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a business.
Mm-hmm.
And the programs were usually designed to get more people to go there and join, which means mm-hmm. more tithing and more income.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that I saw throughout the years, you know, going ahead and giving testimony to what you brought out in the lesson. But look, you know, people who gave a lot of money oftentimes ran the church.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
You know, I saw it over and over and over and over again. And, you know, it's one of the kind of the things that's utterly pathetic about the New Calvinist movement, in that they'll bring Joe Ragamuffin up on church discipline for asking too many questions.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, if you're one that's been, you know, if you're a big mover and shaker that donates huge amounts of money to that New Calvinist church, guess what? They ain't going to bring you up on church discipline. It's not going
right.
to happen. Okay? Nor are they going to bring a guy up on, and I'll just name names. You know, basically the church, the Reformed church I used to go to, Clear Creek Chapel, you know, there was a guy there that was the former, you know, a big mover and shaker there. He was a former president of U.S. Steel. You know, personal mm-hmm. friends with Bill Hybels, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Big-time mover and shaker in Christianity. Well, guess what? They're not going to bring him up on church discipline.
No.
No, they're not. First of all, you know, it's a good way to get sued by people who have money to burn.
Yeah.
Now, you never want to get sued by people who have money to burn. Okay? And, but what's pathetic about it, if I'd be so crass to bring it up tonight, in conjunction with the lesson, you know, these poor suckers, you know, ditch diggers that ask too many questions, they get brought up on church discipline so that the elders can prove what big, bad spiritual guys they are. You
mm-hmm.
know, that
mm-hmm.
by golly, we don't, you know, due to our piety, we don't look the other way on sin. It's really quite disgusting.
Yeah.
And it has become the norm. So, look, I guess in summation, here's the bottom line. As an elder, we were consumed with finances and strategic planning and infrastructure. Now, that's just the bottom line. All of the elders' meetings were about finances, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Clear Creek Chapel was where I was an elder the longest. They always struggled financially, and the reason we always struggled financially is we were, and this is a true testimony, we were half-pregnant Calvinists. And then the real Calvinists came in, you know, the ones that I contended with, and really started running the place like Geneva, okay? And not long after that, the coffers were full and running over. Why? They started bringing up people on church discipline for not tithing enough.
Mm-hmm. And the people were scared out of their minds.
Right. And, you know, the word got out that people were being brought up on church discipline for not tithing, and the money started rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a pathetic testimony.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm stalling for perhaps other people to call in.
We've got about 8 minutes. We've got about 8 minutes left here. Did you want to go ahead and say anything about any of the other programs that you've got going on Blog Talk right now, even this Friday's program?
Oh my! You've only got 8 minutes left, huh? Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So, I'll say a few words before we shut down tonight. We're coming up on the third part of Paul David Tripp's series, three-part series. And this is really the part everybody's been looking for this Friday, Lord willing, when I just leaf through the book and do a flyover and point out the theme of each chapter and the citations. The first two lessons were a lot of history, a lot of contemporary history that I've written a lot about. Now, the first show was pretty good. The second show, really, I was sicker than a dog, and I don't know if it's worth listening to or not. But, I mean, I was just, oh, man. But anyway, so basically we do that this Friday, and then the following Friday we start on the Heidelberg Disputation. And I don't know how many series I'm going to be doing on the Heidelberg Disputation, but we're basically going to rip apart the Heidelberg Disputation sentence by sentence,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And I'm going to show where really Reformation was grounded in world philosophy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Also, let me put in a plug for the conference. And I hope, you know, a lot of our folks at Tank are listening to this. And the plug I want to put in is Susan. Susan is going to be doing a series on Jonathan Edwards, okay? And she's going to be getting into a lot of, you know, the fact that he was 50% a world philosopher as much as he was a theologian. And that dude believed some far-out stuff, man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And to the point to where he's highly regarded amongst a lot of secular world philosophers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Edwards is not only highly regarded in Christianity. He's also highly regarded in amongst some people in world philosophy. And lastly, Tank Associates need to get on the website and sign up because we have several rooms ready and you know, for free lodging and here at the Potter's House. So anybody interested in coming to the conference this year and having a nice, comfortable room free of charge needs to get a hold of us so we can set it aside. We have three, four rooms available. Okay, fully equipped with all the necessary contemporary amenities of life, like cable TV and so on and so forth. And
jacuzzi.
You know, huh?
A jacuzzi.
Yeah, jacuzzi. And so anyway, please contact me so we can go ahead and reserve those rooms for whoever wants free lodging. So looking forward to a great conference this year. And we're going to be starting some radio advertising soon, and really, you know, pushing to try to get a few more people there than usual this year for the speakers to talk to. Although, as we know, the yearly conference is primarily an internet affair. But it's still nice to have, you know, a small crowd to fellowship with and hang out for the weekend and throw all of these discussions around, really hoping that people from developing home networks that have been started will come out for the conference and fellowship with us and pick our brains and really challenge us about this model. So on and so forth.
That is exactly one of the very things that I know I particularly enjoyed being at last year's conference. I mean, I enjoyed listening to the speakers, so listening to you and John and Susan and everything that I learned from each one of those sessions. But I found, you know, great time of edification just getting to sit around with everybody who was there and just discuss these things offline, you know, not during the regular sessions, but just getting to know everybody and talking about these things and sharing experiences. And that was a real blessing to me last year with that.
This year, as we know, as some know, the Potter's House has a lot going on as far as different families and whatnot. And a lot of those people have moved on. And so this year, we don't have a lot of extracurricular activity going on with families here at the Potter's House. So there's going to be a lot more time after hours just to go out to eat or hang around in the conference room / family room or the game room and hang out and, you know, discuss these issues.
That'd be great. Well, listen, we're going to wrap things up here for tonight. And thank you, Paul, for your comments and all the information on that. And we are going to conclude things here for this lesson tonight. And thanks again for being with us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Great lesson from Susan and I from the bottom of our heart. Thank you so hard for your hard work in the book Acts, and we'll see you next week, brother.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Have a good night. Bye-bye. And so that kind of wraps things up. That wraps things up for us here tonight. And as I said, we'll go ahead and join us again next Tuesday night. We'll continue on in our study of the Book of Acts.